session number 10812, rule 3.
General Foote, rule 3.
Positions with his Italian divisions, and to move his mobile corps, including both 15 and 21st Panzer divisions, in a wide sweep round the southern flank. The battle started at 2 p.m. with a frontal attack, which made little progress. That night, he moved his mobile forces round the southern flank. I shall now limit my remarks to my own battalion, the 7th RTR. By May the 29th, the 21st Panzer Division had succeeded in reaching point 209, which was threatening to cut the coast road behind the South African Division. I was ordered to recapture point 209. This didn't prove difficult, as by that time the Germans were short of petrol and ammunition, and Rommel had decided to go on to the defensive and pull in his scattered forces. This he did by withdrawing behind the Sidra Ridge in what became known as the Cauldron. Here he was able to clear a passage back through our minefields and show support, so shorten his supply route. This was placed him behind 150 Brigade box and the 50th Division boxes. For the next 5 days, there was no coordinated attacks by either side. In the northern sector, we probed the enemy defences and moved about to beat off some armoured sorties. During this period, Rommel had been turning his attention onto the 150 Brigade box to his south. On our sector, he had protected himself by dug-in anti-tank guns on the Sidra Ridge and our own minefields. By June the 1st, he had overrun the 150 Brigade box. On the 5th of June, 33rd Armoured Brigade was ordered to make a frontal attack against the Sidra Ridge, while the 10th Indian Infantry Brigade and the 22nd Armoured Brigade were to attack the enemy positions from the southeast. This attack was a disaster, as we had to advance down a gentle slope of about 5 miles before reaching the Sidra Ridge, where the 21st German Panzer Division was dug in with good observation. We tried to cover our advance by putting down smoke, but as soon as the smoke lifted, we became sitting targets. My tank was knocked out, and so was the second tank into which I got.
Can you describe how it was knocked out?
It was knocked out by a direct hit against the tank, which put it out of action, and the tank tracks were broken, so we couldn't move forward.
You were hit by an anti-tank missile?
Anti-tank missile, yes.
So you said that After your tank was knocked out, you got into the second tank.
Second tank, which again was knocked out. No one else fared much better. And when we received orders finally to withdraw, there were not many tanks still mobile in the two regiments. Attempting to rally these, I was hit by a machine gun bullet, but luckily it only grazed my neck. In the end, out of about 70 tanks which started, we got about 12 back. After reorganization, the 7th 42nd Regiment were amalgamated as the 7th 47th under my command. Rommel now resumed his offensive, and by June the 12th was threatening to overrun 201 Guards Brigade, who were holding the Knightsbridge box. I received orders early on the 13th to relieve a cavalry regiment which had run out of ammunition and which was protecting the eastern side of the Knightsbridge box. My orders were to hold off the German armour all that day so that the Guards Brigade could be withdrawn that night. The main problem was that there were no held down positions. The desert here was a flat plain, and we were soon suffering a lot of tank casualties, the leading squadron being practically wiped out. In order to hold out, I decided to deploy my two remaining squadrons on each side of my headquarter tank with orders to conform to my movements. When the enemy started to get our range, I moved our tanks either forwards or backwards a few hundred yards to confuse him. Luckily, with the help of a sandstorm and the use of smoke, we were able to hold out till dark, but at the end of the engagement, we only had 7 operational tanks left. During the battle, I noticed that my own tank was not firing. On asking the gunner, who was my adjutant, Captain McLean, what was the matter, he said he could not close the breech block. On looking outside, I was not surprised, as an enemy shell had gone down the barrel of my two-pounder and had sprayed it out like a skinning a banana. At the end of the day, my crew counted 29 direct hits on my tank, but luckily none had penetrated, and the thick armour we had on the Matilda Mark II. Orders now arrived for 7th RTR to move to Tobruk and to reorganise and draw up replacement tanks. Shortly afterwards, the 8th Army was withdrawn to the frontier, and we were left with 4th LCR to support the 2nd South African Division. Unfortunately, the defences of Brook have been allowed to fall into disarray. Most of the minefields had had been lifted to strengthen the Kazala line. On the 20th of June, Rommel launched a full-scale assault, and after a hard day's fighting, had broken through the defences and was approaching the harbour. 4th and 7th RTR had lost all their tanks in this battle with the two German panzer divisions. That night we planned to make a breakout with 2nd South African Division. But at 3 a.m. we were told that General Copper had been ordered by his government that the South Africans should not suffer a lot of casualties. So he called off the breakout plan and decided to surrender next day. All we could do was to destroy our equipment and hide in caves on the seashore during that day and try to escape next night in small parties. I took three of my headquarters staff and made for Bardeur as soon as it got dark. We shot off southeast and crossed the Tobruk Bardeur Road and up onto the escarpment. On the way, we walked through a German tank regiment, Liga, with all their crews fast asleep outside their tanks. They did not appear to have any sentries, and I presumed that as the garrison had surrendered, there was no need for them. After walking about 5 miles, it started to get light, so I decided we better find a place to lay up in by day. We came to a ravine which had some caves in it, so I told the others to wait, and I went down to see if they were suitable. Unfortunately, I slipped on a loose stone, fell down and broke a bone in my ankle. The others helped me up into the cave, and we lay there all that day. Next night, the others set out to see if they could find a band of Birkel, but did not have any luck. Next day, during the afternoon, a party of German soldiers came to look at the burnt-out Valentine tank. They must have seen us, as shortly afterwards we were surrounded and taken to the prisoner of war enclosure in Tobruk, where I was transferred to the Tobruk Beach Hospital. Here I found it was still being run by our brigade field ambulance, and a surgeon set my leg and set it in plaster. I was to stay in this hospital until the end of July, when I was evacuated in an Italian ship, the Critica, to Italy. I was shaken when the hospital ship sailed first to Merzimetru to pick up German and Italian wounded. On the hospital ship, the officers fed in the first class saloon. There were three tables, one German, one Italian, and one British. And we found that the Germans and Italians would not speak to each other, but both would talk to us. On arrival in Naples, I was taken by ambulance to a transit hospital near Caserta, here to become Allied headquarters, later to become Allied headquarters. The next day, I was sent by hospital train with an Italian guard to a hospital in Bergamo, near the Swiss frontier.
Bergamo.
Where, when I was, my leg was all right again, I was transferred to Sulmona, halfway between Rome, Emden and Kona. This was an Australian POW camp, and I made a number of friends there. I arrived there on the 31st of August and was stayed there until the 27th of October, when I was transferred to Viano, a new British POW camp which had previously been a religious college. Viano was situated about 15 miles south of Piacenza in the Po Valley. On the 3rd of September 1943, Italy capitulated, and on the 5th of September, the Italian colonel, who was the commandant of the camp, sent for the senior British officer, Colonel Younghusband, and I accompanied him. We were told that as far as the Italians were concerned, the war was over, and we were free to do what we liked. We asked him what the Germans were doing. He said he didn't know, and that there was an Italian division in Piacenza. We decided to stay in the camp until we could get more information. But as a precaution, we arranged with the Italian commandant that he would send some of his officers in mufti to Piacenza to find out what was happening there. We also arranged for them to post his guards on all approaches, roads to the camp, with a British officer in command, so we would not be surprised. The orders given to us were to stay put until we were relieved by the British or American army. On the 10th of September, some of the Italian officers returned to say that the Italian division in Piacenza had been disarmed by a German division, and that the Germans were preparing to march on the camp. On receipt of this information, we decided to split up into two groups and escape into the mountains to the south and lay up until the British or Americans arrived. I had a party of seven. We took with us as much food as we could carry from the camp, from our Red Cross parcels, and what food the Italians could provide. We left about midday on the 11th of September and were resting that evening halfway up the mountain when we saw what looked like German patrols with torches coming up the mountain. Shortly afterwards, an Alsatian dog came up to us. One of our party patted it on the head and said, "Good dog," and it immediately went back down the mountain. Needless to say, we legged it up the mountain and put a few miles on before we stopped. We decided to lay up by day and move by night. Our intention was to make for the mountains overlooking Genoa in case the British landed in that area. For 4 or 5 days we lay up in the mountains near Foligno. After our 5 days, food was running out, and we reduced to a ration of 2 slices of stale bread and 7 raisins each. So we decided to send one of our party who spoke Italian to make contact with a mountain village which was nearby to see if the villagers were friendly. He came back to say they were friendly and prepared to help us. They were all communists, anti-fascists and anti-German. We stayed in the village for a few days and then moved on to another village and again found the inhabitants very friendly. They gave us peasant clothing in place of our uniforms. We were told that the German troops were still in the Salerno area. We helped the villagers in their fields in exchange for food and shelter. And we made friends with an Italian family who were evacuees from Milan, where they had owned a flat and they had left on account of a British bombing. One day, whilst we were working in the fields, a woman on horseback came along and said, "You don't look like Italians."
And well, she said this in Italian?
No, in English. And when she realised we were British, she told us we had a house in the valley below and would be delighted to put us up in a more comfortable conditions. I told her we would think about it. Although some of the younger subalterns were all for it, I was very suspicious and decided to move out of the village. Although she chased us for 2 days, we were able to give her the slip, which was lucky. As we found out afterwards, she was married to the colonel in charge of a German hospital in the valley below. If we had gone there, we'd probably have been shipped off to Germany within 24 hours. When the coast was clear, we were able to move back to the village, where we slept in a barn on straw, the only problem being that there were rats which ran over us at night. We were still hoping that the Allies might land in the Genoa area, but by the middle of October we realised this was unlikely, so we had to decide whether to go south and try and make our way to the Allied lines or to go north into Switzerland. With the winter coming on, we decided to make for Switzerland. We knew that there were some escape organisations in Milan, and so we arranged for one of my officers to go there with the son of the Italian family who had befriended us. He was about 19 years of age. Within 48 hours they came back and said that they had contacted 3 escape organisations and had chosen what they thought was the best one, called the Action Party. We therefore decided to go to Milan, but agreed that 7 was too big a party to go by train. So we split the party in half. One half would go by train and the other would go by another route. I and 3 of my young officers set off with the young Italian. We walked over the mountains to Bitola and took a train on the mountain railway to Piacenza, the young man bought our tickets to Milan for us. At Piacenza, we had to train stations from the mountain railway to the main line. From the timetable, we knew we would have a 2-hour wait, and we decided that we would walk around Piacenza rather than wait on the platform. When we reached Piacenza, standing on the at the barrier was in the second in command of our prison camp in Italian uniform. We pulled our hats over our eyes and showed our tickets at the barrier, expecting a shout or a tap on the shoulders, but luckily nothing happened. I don't know whether he recognized us or not, but we didn't linger. I thought that if we walked round in a circle, we'd get back to the station. However, after 1.5 hours, we realized we lost our way. I then decided that we'd ask the first old woman walking alone the way to the station. But the first woman we met either didn't understand us or was too frightened, as she shook her head and hurried off. However, the second woman we asked said in English she would show us there. For a moment I was worried that she might take us to a police station, but after going round a few corners we saw the railway station ahead of us. We then found that the Milan train was 2 hours late, so we had to stay on the platform. As there were several German soldiers and Flemish police on the platform, we split into two groups. One group stood near a telephone kiosk, and shortly two young Italian girls went to the telephone but had no change. So they asked the officers if they could help. Neither of them could speak Italian and could only shake their heads. The Italian girls were obviously puzzled, shrugged their shoulders, and went off to try someone else. It was so funny, we burst into fits of laughter. I think they mistook our officers for foreign workers. When the train eventually arrived, it was so full that we couldn't get onto it.